Everything's relative. That's the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. Just starting with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. And here's how it applies to the tax breaks currently being considered, which is all about the very rich getting even richer. The thing is, the very rich getting even richer isn't going to make them any happier, because the very point of being wealthier than anyone else is being able to buy things that those that are less wealthy than you can't buy, and feeling that you're now special and being able to show off those things to people who are less special. But of course, if everyone in your 1% category is increasing their spending power in the exact same way, you're just going to be on the same base level with them that you always were. Your super duper wealth will become the new normal. Your jubilation, if you happen to be one of all those Republicans lining up saying, get this done or don't ever count on my donations again, if they do win this tax break for themselves, won't last very long. Because how many homes and cars and super expensive toys can you buy in the end? Especially if all your peers can buy the same ones too. Anyway, that's the thesis of Robert Frank, an economics professor at Cornell. He explains that special is a relative concept. A spacious home is one that's larger than most other homes. A high-performance car is one that outperforms other cars. Acquiring special things depends on your relative purchasing power. Taxes don't affect relative purchasing power. They affect absolute purchasing power. And so the ability of the rich to get something special isn't enhanced by tax cuts. When, for instance, we happen to lose what we had before, whether it be possessions, a home that's lost in the fire, money, our jobs, and therefore our income, these are things impoverishing us personally, but it doesn't affect the rest of the world. When everyone's going through the same thing, it's very different. And when everyone's spendable income goes up or down together, then our relative purchasing power remains as it was. It's all about context. Robert Frank provides an example. He says, suppose you're driving kids or grandkids off to see some friends, and they say, are we there yet? Well, if you're 10 miles toward the end of a 100-mile journey, you're going to say, yes, we are almost there. But if you're 10 miles away from a 15 or 20-mile journey, you're going to say, no, we're not. Similarly, if you suggest to someone in Miami that it's cold when it's 60 degrees in November, it's going to be laughable if you say the same thing to someone living in northern Canada. It also depends if you're asking whether 60 degrees is cold in July or February. Context, then, not actuality, is key. Things stop being special when everyone experiences them or everyone has access to the same things. Everything's relative. That's the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight on Laguna's KX935. So when you lower taxes for the very rich, they're not really getting anything more for their money, because they're now competing with their peers on base one again. Robert Frank goes on to give an even more pertinent example. He says, imagine you're a car enthusiast and you're given two options. You can buy a Porsche 911 Turbo and drive it on well-maintained highways, or you can have a Ferrari F12 Berlinetti, but you're going to be driving it on roads riddled with potholes. I think almost everyone would say, well, the Porsche is certainly a flashy, extravagant car. Everyone knows that I'll have paid a lot of money for it. Yes, the Ferrari is double the cost, but is it really worth having it when I'm the one driving it and the drive will be kind of a nightmare? Both luxury cars, and all things being equal, you'd probably opt for the more expensive car, but given how the performance is going to be relative to the conditions, you'd probably make a different choice. Having something super high performance in a low performance context is probably not as good as having something relatively high performance in a relatively compatible environment. It's a good analogy because that's exactly what's going on with these tax breaks for the very wealthy. Infrastructure is being marginalized in favor of the money in our pockets. But what that money buys is liable to be compromised. And it's this thing of relativity. And what happens when one person spends less on a car is very different from when everyone spends less on a car, because if you're one person, you feel deprived. But if you're one of everyone, it's just that standards have changed. It's kind of like when our parents bought their houses for $20,000 in the 1950s and they're worth 20 million now. It's the same house, it's just that standards have changed and different values have been assigned to the exact same item, and your frame of reference changes. Everything's Relative is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. Let's hear what ad man Rory Sutherland has to say on the topic in his TED talk.
The whole debate in the Western world is about the level of taxation. But I think there's another debate to be asked, which is the level of control we have over our tax money. That what costs us £10 in one context can be a curse. What costs us £10 in a different context, we may actually welcome. You know, pay £20,000 in tax towards health, and you're merely feeling a mug. Pay £20,000 to endow a hospital ward, and you're called a philanthropist. So how you frame things really matters. I think psychological value is great. One of my great friends, a professor called Nick Chater, who is the professor of decision sciences in London, believes that we should spend far less time looking into humanity's hidden depths and spend much more time exploring the hidden shallows. I think that's true, actually. I think impressions have an insane effect on what we think and what we do. But what we don't have is a really good model of human psychology, at least pre-Kahneman, perhaps. We didn't have a really good model of human psychology to put alongside models of engineering, of neoclassical economics. So people who believed in psychological solutions didn't have a model. We didn't have a framework. This is what Warren Buffett's business partner Charlie Munger calls a lattice work on which to hang your ideas. We merely had a collection of random individual insights without an overall model. And what that means is that in looking at solutions, we've probably given too much priority to what I'd call technical engineering solutions, Newtonian solutions, and not nearly enough to psychological ones. I'd give my example of the Eurostar. £6 million spent to reduce the journey time between Paris and London by about 40 minutes. For maybe 10% of the money, you could have paid all of the world's top male and female supermodels to walk up and down the train, handing out free Chateau Petrus to all the passengers. You'd still have £5 billion in change, and people would ask for the trains to be slowed down. Why were we not given the chance to solve that problem psychologically? I think it's because there's an imbalance, an asymmetry, in the way we treat creative, emotionally driven psychological ideas versus the way we treat rational, numerical, spreadsheet-driven ideas. An example of a great psychological idea, the single best improvement in passenger satisfaction on the London Underground per pound spent came when they didn't add any extra trains nor change the frequency of the trains. They put dot matrix display boards on the platforms. Because the nature of a wait is not just dependent on its numerical quality, its duration, but on the level of uncertainty you experience during that wait. Waiting 7 minutes for a train with a countdown clock is less frustrating and irritating than waiting 4 minutes, knuckle-biting, going, when's this train going to damn well arrive? Here's a beautiful example of a psychological solution deployed in Korea. Red traffic lights have a countdown delay. It's proven to reduce the accident rate in experiments. Why? Because road rage, impatience, and general irritation are massively reduced when you can actually see the time you have to wait. In China, not really understanding the principle behind this, they applied the same principle to green traffic lights, which isn't a great idea. You're 200 yards away, you realize you've got 5 seconds to go, you floor it. The Koreans very assiduously did test both. The accident rate goes down when you apply this to red traffic lights, it goes up when you apply it to green traffic lights. This is all I'm asking for, really, in human decision-making, is the consideration of these three things. I'm not asking for the complete primacy of one over the other. I'm merely saying that when you solve problems, you should look at all three of these equally, and you should seek as far as possible to find solutions which sit in the sweet spot in the middle. If you actually look at a great business, you'll nearly always see all of these three things coming into play. Google is a great, great technological success, but it's also based on a very good psychological insight. People believe something that only does one thing is better at that thing than something that does that thing and something else. It's an innate thing called goal dilution. Ayelet Fishback has written a paper about this. Everybody else at the time of Google, more or less, was trying to be a portal. Yes, there's a search function, but you also have weather, sports scores, bits of news. Google understood that if you're just a search engine, people assume you're a very, very good search engine. All of you know this, actually, from when you go in to buy a television. And in the shabbier end of the row of flat-screen TVs, you can see, are these rather despised things called combined TV and DVD players. And we have no knowledge whatsoever of the quality of those things, but we look at a combined TV and DVD player and we go, ugh, it's probably a bit of a crap telly and a bit rubbish as a DVD player. Google is as much a psychological success as it is a technological one.
You can tell this is an old TED Talk. Combo TVs and DVDs are an antiquity these days. You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. Here's more from Admin Rory Sutherland related to my tonight's topic of everything being relative. It's all about context, which is why psychological solutions can be better than pie chart kind of ones.
I propose that we can use psychology to solve problems that we didn't even realize were problems at all. This is my suggestion for getting people to finish their course of antibiotics. Don't give them 24 white pills, give them 18 white pills and 6 blue ones, and tell them to take the white pills first and then take the blue ones. It's called chunking. The likelihood that people will get to the end is much greater when there is a milestone somewhere in the middle. One of the great mistakes, I think, of economics is it fails to understand that what something is, whether it's retirement, unemployment, cost, is a function not only of its amount, but also its meaning. We tend, all of us, even those of us who work in marketing, to think of value in two ways. There's the real value, which is when you make something in a factory or provide a service, and then there's a kind of dubious value, which you create by changing the way people look at things. Some strange economists called the French physiocrats rejected this distinction and believed that true value was only what you extracted from the land. So if you were a shepherd or a quarryman or a farmer, you created true value. If, however, you bought some wool from the shepherd and charged a premium for converting it into a hat, you weren't actually creating value, you were exploiting the shepherd. Now, modern economists make exactly the same mistake with regard to advertising and marketing. If you run a restaurant, there is no healthy distinction to be made between the value you create by cooking the food and the value you create by sweeping the floor. One of them creates perhaps the primary product, the thing we think we're paying for. The other one creates a context within which we can enjoy and appreciate that product. And the idea that one of them should actually have priority over the other is fundamentally wrong. Try this quick thought experiment. Imagine a restaurant that serves Michelin-starred food, but where the restaurant smells of sewage and there's human feces on the floor. The best thing you can do there to create value is not actually to improve the food still further, it's to get rid of the smell and clean up the floor. And it's vital we understand this. If that seems like a sort of strange, abstruse thing, in the UK, the post office had a 98% success rate at delivering first-class mail the next day. They decided this wasn't good enough and they wanted to get it up to 99. The effort to do that almost broke the organization. If at the same time you'd gone and asked people what percentage of first-class mail arrives the next day, the average answer would have been 50 to 60%. Now, if your perception's much worse than your reality, what on earth are you doing trying to change the reality? That's like trying to improve the food in a restaurant that stinks. What you need to do is, first of all, tell people that 98% of mail gets there the next day, first-class mail. That's pretty good. I would argue in Britain there's a much better frame of reference, which is to tell people that more first-class mail arrives the next day in the UK than in Germany. Because generally in Britain, if you want to make us happy about something, just tell us we do it better than the Germans. Choose your frame of reference, and the perceived value, therefore the actual value, is completely transformed. What you'll also notice is that in any case, our perception is leaky. We can't tell the difference between the quality of the food and the environment in which we consume it. All of you will have seen this phenomenon. If you have your car washed or valeted, when you drive away, your car feels as if it drives better. And the reason for this, unless my car valet mysteriously is changing the oil and performing work which I'm not paying him for and I'm unaware of, is because perception is in any case leaky. Analgesics that are branded are more effective at reducing pain than analgesics that are not branded. I don't just mean through reported pain reduction, actual measured pain reduction. And so perception actually is leaky in any case. So if you do something that's perceptually bad in one respect, you can damage the other. I think one of the problems with classical economics is it's absolutely preoccupied with reality. And reality isn't a particularly good guide to human happiness. Why, for example, are pensioners much happier than the young unemployed? Both of them, after all, are in exactly the same state of life. You both have too much time on your hands and not much money. But pensioners are reportedly very, very happy, whereas the unemployed are extraordinarily unhappy and depressed. The reason, I think, is that the pensioners believe they've chosen to be pensioners, whereas the young unemployed feel it's been thrust upon them. In England, the upper middle classes have actually solved this problem perfectly because they've rebranded unemployment. If you're an upper middle class English person, you call unemployment a year off. The power to rebrand things, to understand that actually our experiences, costs, things, don't actually much depend on what they really are, but on how we view them, I genuinely think can't be overstated. There's an experiment I think Daniel Pink refers to where you put two dogs in a box and the box has an electric floor. Every now and then, an electric shock is applied to the floor, which pains the dogs. The only difference is one of the dogs has a small button in its half of the box, and when it nuzzles the button, the electric shock stops. The other dog doesn't have the button. It's exposed to exactly the same level of pain as the dog in the first box, but it has no control over the circumstances. Generally, the first dog can be relatively content. The second dog lapses into complete depression. The circumstances of our lives may actually matter less to our happiness than the sense of control we feel over our lives.
Everything's relative. That's the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 935. Let's turn to something more mundane, dating. Dating, if you live in, say, China, can be a relative experience too, in terms of access. Another Times article by Su Liwei presents the case of Zhang Zengxiu, who's 27 years old, has never been in a relationship, has never kissed a woman. Like many in China, he doesn't know how to go after love on his own. This is a country in which for decades, marriages were arranged through families or official matchmakers. In some places, parents still post the resumes of their single children on trees and lampposts. So, what's a person like Zhang to do? Well, he turned to a dating coach via the Fall in Love Emotional Education School, which taught him how to flirt and conduct basic grooming. He took a 3-day course with them and discovered that it wasn't so much that there was something wrong with him, it's that he and many others don't know what details to pay attention to. You have to realize that China till very recently had a one-child policy. This was in a country that favors males so completely that many couples abort female fetuses. Last year, there were around 33 million more men than women in China, according to government polls. But now China worries that there's a surplus of unhappy single men that could lead to an increase in human trafficking or sex crimes, certainly social instability. So now it's the government playing matchmaker. Recently, the Communist Youth League organized a mass speed dating event for 2,000 young singles, while the All China Women's Federation helped organize a similar event for, quote, leftover men and women. That's a term used in China to refer to unmarried people in their late 20s or older. Marriage was basically for people to start a family. Even when the notion of free love or freedom to love became popular in the 50s, there were very few venues where people could actually get together, mingle, snuggle. And sex outside marriage was illegal until the late 1990s. So Zhang got a dating coach, Mr. Mindong. Mr. Mindong called himself a loser, said he'd suffered from a painful breakup 5 years earlier, and turned to the internet to find solutions. That's where he discovered the term pickup artist and started his school, which he now runs with a couple of other people in their 20s in the eastern city of Jinan. They charge anywhere from $45 for an online course to about $3,000 for one-on-one coaching. And they're not the only school that's opened up in several Chinese cities. As for the offline government course at Fall in Love Emotional Education, they have more than 300 subscribers and claim that about 90% of their graduates end up with girlfriends. These subscribers include several 20-somethings, a software designer, a small business owner, and a doctor who specializes in cancer. They're taught to improve their clothes. Quote, narrow collars, sleeves should be folded up above the elbow, and trousers should be fitted. They're encouraged to get haircuts and wash their hair more frequently. says Mr. Mindong, the coach. Many Chinese men let themselves go. They don't wash their hair or change their clothes. They become really dirty. But that's not the case for women. And this is why so many Chinese men can't have a long-term relationship. Part of the training involves having the students pose for photos reading Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time, sipping tea, and nibbling canapes presented in a silver birdcage, looking pensively out of a window. Getting to know you apparently takes place almost exclusively on WeChat, a popular social media site used by nearly 1 billion people. Our dating student was taken off to a shopping mall to strut his stuff. Apparently he rushed up to two women, who did pause but then continued walking. He chased after them and stopped them again, but they walked away again. "I didn't succeed," a dejected Mr. Zhang said, returning to the group of other students. "No, the fact that you approached them means you did succeed," he was told, with a pat on the back. And by the end of the night, everybody had got somebody to agree to be a WeChat contact. Meanwhile, he practiced real smiles and flirtatious banter with their coaches. Our guy, Zhang Shengxiao, said he never learned how to talk to a woman. His high school forbade students from mixing with members of the opposite sex. And his parents had had an arranged marriage. But now they want him to settle down. And he's thinking, there must be many single women just like me, all longing for love. On his part, he's looking for a bubbly tomboy who likes wearing jeans and not skirts all the time. This is the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James. My topic tonight is Everything's Relative. And you're tuned to Laguna's one and only listener-supported, member-supported public FM radio station, KX935. Here's someone who dated very successfully, can count A-Rod as one of her conquests. At the age of 33, Anne Wijkiki was a very rich girl. She was just about to get a new mail-order genetic testing firm, 23andMe, off the ground. She was married to Sergey Brin, co-founder of Google. He was also 33 and also extremely rich. They got married, she in a white bathing suit, he in a black one, in the middle of the ocean in the Bahamas. Sergey owned a yacht and a fleet of jets. And soon Anne Wijkiki was pregnant with the first of their two children. Brilliant, right? Fairy tale life. Except 6 years later, a year short of the seven-year itch, Sergey Brin had an affair. I'm reading, by the way, from an article by Maureen Dowd in the New York Times. She explains, along with the breakup of the marriage, the FDA shut down the primary function of Anne Wijkiki's business, calling her DNA spit vial a, quote, unapproved medical device, and imposing stricter rules for consumer genetic testing. A business which had so much promise became reduced to an ancestry testing division. But she had a very solid family background, did Anne. She grew up in Silicon Valley royalty. Her father was the former chairman of the Stanford Physics Department, an emeritus professor. Her mother is a journalism teacher, so beloved at Palo Alto High School that James Franco, the actor, made a video peon to her. Of her sisters, one is now the CEO of YouTube, and the other is an epidemiologist and medical anthropologist and associate professor at UC San Francisco School of Medicine, not to mention a Fulbright scholar. Anne says her mother is utterly the believer that she can get anything done and had a real fighter mentality, didn't mind controversy. So all the girls were raised that way. There was a brother too, but he died when she was little. But she says, you don't let a bad experience hold you back, otherwise you spend the rest of your life ruined by that experience. It doesn't matter what happened today, make it better tomorrow, is her philosophy. And she used it on herself when her marriage and business got the better of her. She ultimately learned that her former husband, and she learned this from her own spit test applied to him, that he had a rare genetic mutation that increased the risk for Parkinson's. She could have done something vengeful with that information, if just to turn her back on him. Instead, she bought the patent on a gene variation that could protect people who have that Parkinson's-related mutation. Friends wonder whether if Bryn had learnt about his Parkinson's risk before he went off and had his affair, he might not have. But also, had his ex-wife not discovered it for him, he might not have enacted the healthy lifestyle choices that are helping prolong his life. Everything's relative. That's the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. I'm Sharon James, and this is Laguna's KX935 FM public radio station. Talking about Anne Wojcicki at the moment, Silicon Valley entrepreneur and former wife of one of the founders of Google. She said, "I never want to be angry. My theory is that you're only hurting yourself when you're angry and vengeful. I was mad, but I don't carry grudges. He's the grandfather of my grandchildren. If he made his own life difficult, I can still be civil to him. Why not? What's in it for me being nasty?" And she has very fun memories of the fun of hanging out with the Google team, Sergey and his co-founder Larry Page. She said they genuinely see the world in a different way, and that's what's fun. Like, the sky is not blue, it's some other shade.
They say, as a child, I appeared a little bit wild with all my crazy ideas. But I knew what was happening, I knew I was a genius. What's so strange when you know that you're a wizard at three? I knew that this was meant to be. Now I heard little children were supposed to sleep tight. That's why I got into the vodka one night. My parents got frantic, didn't know what to do. But I saw some crazy scenes before I came to now. Do you think I was crazy? I may have been only three, but I was swinging. They all up at angry young men. They all up at Edison and also at Einstein. So why should I feel sorry if they just couldn't understand the idiomatic logic that went on in my head? I had a brain, it was insane. Oh, they used to laugh at me when I refused to ride on all those double-decker buses, all because there was no driver on the top.
What, no driver on the top?
And the chick is twisted, crazy, oop-shooby, here, flip city.
My analyst told me that I was right out of my head, but I said, "Dear doctor, I think that it's you instead, because I have got a thing that's unique and new. To prove it, I'll have the last laugh on you, cause instead of one head, I got two. And you know two heads are better than one."
Genius or madmen, those internet whiz kids. In the case of Sergey Brin, co-founder with Larry Page of Google, not so mad really. Although there was a coup de foudre with a fellow internet entrepreneur that ultimately broke up his marriage. Anne was angry with him at the time, but chose not to carry that around with her. She says they still see a lot of each other, and things worked out fine for her. She started dating a strapping man who said he was a baseball player. She asked a friend if he knew who Alex Rodriguez was. And her friend explained that he was only one of the best baseball players who'd ever lived. She said, "When I first started dating him, my mum said, 'What's an A-Rod?' I said, 'Mum, that's his name.' Not knowing anything about baseball, but being a math whiz, she started to learn every baseball stat, and the two were able to enjoy their cultural collision romance, as Maureen Dowd calls it. And even installed different TV sets in her house so A-Rod could watch baseball while she did her own thing. But they were extremely different and lived on different coasts and eventually parted. Anne's mom said, "I liked A-Rod. He was a very nice man. We liked his family. He seemed to genuinely love Anne, but I figured this was a mismatch. He had no academic background. We couldn't have an intellectual conversation about anything. His main interest in life was something that none of us had ever focused on, and he could park himself in front of a TV and watch baseball for 10 hours a day. He wasn't even sure he wanted to go on the yacht with Anne because the TV might not be working. And we couldn't go anywhere with him. If we went to Target to look at clothes for the kids, people would be rushing up for a selfie with him. He can't walk across Central Park. He has to take a cab everywhere. It'll all work better with J-Lo because she's like, 'Take a picture of me anytime.'" As for Anne, she said, "I prefer to date someone who's really simple and not famous. My life's already pretty complicated. So everything's relative, huh? The yacht being irrelevant to the millionaire baseball star, the millionaire baseball star being irrelevant to the woman with the yacht.
Elegant junk.
It's shiny.
Who wants to be a millionaire?
I don't.
Have flashy flunkies everywhere?
I don't.
Who wants the bother of a country estate?
A country estate is something I'd hate.
Who wants to wallow in champagne?
I don't.
Who wants a supersonic plane?
I don't.
Who wants a private landing field to
wait? I don't.
And I don't,
cause all I want is you.
Who wants to be a millionaire?
I don't.
Who wants uranium to spare?
I don't.
Who wants to journey on a gigantic yacht?
Do I want a yacht? Oh, how I do not. Who wants a fancy foreign car?
I don't.
Who wants to tire of caviar?
Who wants a marble swimming pool too?
I don't.
And I don't. Cause all I want is you.
The scene from High Society with Frank Sinatra and Celeste Holm poring over all the wedding gifts for the wealthy heiress played by Grace Kelly. If you have it, you don't need it. Everything's relative. Everything's relative is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. I'm talking about Anne Wojcicki, who was married to the co-founder of Google and then dated A-Rod. Her mother explained that it didn't really work for them because they couldn't go to Target with A-Rod without everyone inundating them with requests for selfies. The fact that all these people were at Target, considering they could afford to shop anywhere, is kind of admirable, don't you think, listener? It shows an understanding of what you really need from life, which of course we all clearly know is Target. And been taught by her mother to be skeptical of anything too flashy or polished. Even though she now owns a $1 billion company, she says, fancy cars, houses, the right dress, not a top priority. She says her sister went to the Oscars with her last year, and literally at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you're supposed to be ready at 5, she's calling me like, I'm in Macy's, I found a dress on sale. She still rides her bike to work every day, even in the rain, and she shops at Payless Shoes, even though she has the occasional Louboutin in her closet. And she makes a huge effort to keep her children, too, from slipping into the insanity of mega wealth. She said, I had people who cleaned the house 3 days a week, and I just told them to stop doing laundry on Fridays because my kids need to learn how to do laundry on Fridays. It's so easy to be like, I never have to do laundry again, I never have to cook again, but then you're not normal. I have a new rule lately, I don't go out on weekdays. If I'm raising kids, I need to be focused on helping implement that normalcy. She says, the other thing, when we travel in summers, because I don't like to pack a lot, I'd have the kids bathe in their clothes and then change into something else. And that means that their clothes are clean for the next day versus the hotel laundry, which is so expensive. Expensive to someone who owns and runs a $1 billion company. I'd say that's relative, wouldn't you? You're tuned to the Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX935. I'm Sharon James, and my topic tonight is Everything's Relative. I'm currently talking about Anne Wojcicki, who was married to the co-founder of Google and had her own thriving internet business, an online genetics-related one. And then you could say it all crumbled when her husband ran off with another woman and the FDA tried to close down her business, except she managed to maintain a good relationship with the father of her children, and she managed to turn her business around from something the FDA was attempting to eradicate to something they could agree on. She didn't huff and puff and seethe and backbite. She put one foot in front of the other, as her mother advised, hired the best regulatory experts, discovered that they were not communicating with the FDA in the right way. She describes it as running around with our shoes on in a Japanese house. We weren't expressing ourselves correctly. We weren't a cultural fit. She says, some companies just try to circumvent the regulators. We weren't. We just got caught in the crosshairs and somehow pissed them off. And it took a long time to generate a lot of data to prove that our intentions actually were right. It's genetics. And she sees it now from an FDA perspective that as a new product, it can cause anxiety. So the onus was on her and her team to change course and get it right. She explained to her team, listen, when you go to the DMV, you don't argue about the vision test. You don't say, oh, I just had a vision test. I don't need to do it. You just do it. The FDA is in charge of public safety, and I have a respect for the job that they have to do, and we're just going to do the job that they're asking us to do. Which is a pretty elegant way of resolving things, don't you think, listener? You're tuned to The Sharer now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My topic tonight is everything's relative. Pleasure is relative, but so is pain, and they're often interconnected to a relative degree. I actually did a show quite a while ago on this, my Sharer now, if you care to look it up, and it was called The Value of Unhappiness, because unhappiness and pain actually do have value and need a place in our lives. We shouldn't necessarily be constantly pushing pain away or making sure it plays no part in our loved ones' lives. Here's Australian psychologist Brock Bastian to give you his opinions on this from his TED Talk.
Let me tell you a story. About 6 years ago, my wife gave birth to twins. What I remember is thinking to myself, there is a design flaw here. This is simply not going to happen. My wife is going to turn around to me any moment and say, nope, this is not happening, let's just go home. Well, it did happen. She did it completely naturally. Not even a Panadol passed her lips. I, on the other hand, did have a Panadol because I developed a stress-related headache. Women have this incredible ability to forget the details of the birth process. This is probably for adaptive reasons, because if you remember what I remember, you would never go back and do it again. This experience taught me two things. The first, my pain threshold is much lower than my wife's. The second has to do with something that she said to me right in the midst of the birth process. She looked at me, the pupils of her eyes fully dilated, and she said, "This feels so good." Now, I wouldn't make that up, no matter how bad her memory. This made me realise that the distinction between pain and pleasure is not as obvious as it may at first seem. You know, the pain-killing industry is massive, not only for physical pain, but also for emotional pain. We're told that the pain-free life, the happy life, is the good life. Yet on the flip side, even common and everyday mild experiences of pain and sadness are viewed as pathological, as things that need to be medicated and eradicated. From this perspective, pain is simply something which gets in our way of being happy in life. But is this the right way to be looking at pain? Could this be leading to other sorts of problems? You know, our belief that we should avoid pain is also evident in how we are raising our children. We want to protect our children from taking risks, from experiencing pain and failure and loss in life. We believe that our children should be happy and pain-free. And this is evident in the everyone wins mentality that seems to have emerged within recent years. Did you know that in the 1960s, B's and C's were the most common grades awarded to students in American colleges and universities? But by 2008, A's had become the most common. It seems that even our educational systems have been shaped by this belief that our children should be protected from failure and disappointment in life. But this mollycoddling is having devastating consequences. Over this same period of time, narcissistic personality traits have been on the rise. It's no wonder we talk about the age of entitlement. Over this same period of time, depression has been on the rise. You know, it's interesting, we vaccinate our children because we know that giving them a small amount of a pathogen will strengthen their biological immunity so they can deal better with that pathogen in the future. Yet we forget that the same principle applies psychologically. Exposing our children to pain and failure and loss strengthens their psychological immune system. It builds their psychological immunity so they can deal better with those experiences in the future. By protecting our children from these experiences, we're making them less resilient and more emotionally vulnerable.
And it can work both ways. They can then feel responsible if anything goes wrong in our experience as their parents. They can take it on themselves. The pathos of this song I'm going to play from the musical Sweeney Todd always makes me cry.
Nothing's gonna harm you, not while I'm around. Nothing's come. Not to worry, Mom. No one's gonna hurt you. No one's gonna dare. Others can desert you.
You're tuned to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My topic tonight is Everything's Relative, and Australian psychologist Brock Bastian has a theory that without pain, there's no pleasure, so we shouldn't run from pain. This is from his TED Talk.
My interest in pain is not from the clinical perspective, but rather from the social perspective. I'm interested in how we value pain and how this feeds in to our assumptions about happiness. I want you just right now to think about a pleasure that you really enjoy. Have a quick think. Who just thought about chocolate? People love chocolate. It has two of the most rewarding substances known to man, fat and sugar. Now I want you to just take a moment and imagine placing a square of your favourite chocolate in your mouth and just letting it slowly melt. Now take another. Do the same thing again. Take another. Why not? Take four. In fact, a group of researchers did this, and they found that after the fifth piece of chocolate, people started to rate the experience as unpleasant. And after the seventh, they were indicating that eating another would make them feel sick. Now, this is completely crazy, right? Because I can eat at least seven pieces of chocolate and still enjoy the experience. But I think the point is clear, even for the chocoholics among us. You can't eat chocolate endlessly. It will eventually make you feel sick. So pleasure can quickly turn to pain. But just so, pain can also turn to pleasure. One of the reasons that pain can turn to pleasure is that both pain and pleasure activate the same neural regions in our brain. They both activate the release of opioids. Now, opioids are kind of like the body's natural Panadol. They act to reduce pain, but it just so happens they also increase our experience of pleasure. Now, anyone who is a runner will know exactly what I mean. Runners often refer to an experience of euphoria after a particularly intense run. This is commonly referred to as the runner's high. By pushing our body against the pain threshold, we are literally able to increase our experience of pleasure in life. Yet if we seek endless pleasure, it quickly turns to pain.
Cigarettes and chocolate milk. These are just a couple of my revenge. Everything it seems I like's a little bit stronger, a little bit thicker, a little bit
You are tuned to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX 935. My topic on tonight's show is Everything's Relative, and we're currently listening to a TED Talk by Australian psychologist Brock Bastian, who's pointing out how pain and pleasure are relative to each other as well as in context. They're actually activated in the same neural region of the brain, the part that releases opioids. Which is why, for instance, chocolate can give us inordinate pleasure and inordinate pain after eating a pound of it. But we shouldn't be avoiding pain. It can be a vital thing.
This doesn't mean that we should be seeking endless pain either. It seems that maybe some pain is best. Now, after people indicated how much adversity they had in their lives, researchers asked them to put their hand into a bucket of iced water and hold it there for as long as they could. What they found, the people with little lifetime adversity took their hand out more quickly. The people with a lot of lifetime adversity, they held their hand in the ice bucket for longer. And what's interesting is both of these groups reported more pain. It was the people in the middle, the people with a moderate amount of lifetime adversity, who held their hand in the ice bucket just as long as anybody else did, who reported the least amount of pain. They coped the best. Now, what's interesting is this same group of researchers in a different study asked people about their levels of happiness and well-being in life, and they found the same pattern again. It was the people with a moderate amount of lifetime adversity who were the happiest, who had the highest levels of well-being. It just so happens they ran that survey over the period of the 9/11 attacks in New York so they could assess how people coped with the stress and trauma of that experience. And again, they found the same pattern. It was the people with a moderate amount of lifetime adversity who coped the best. So it seems that some pain really can build resilience.
I was happy in the haze of a drunken hour, but heaven knows I'm miserable now. I was looking for a job and then I found a job, and heaven knows I'm miserable now in my life. Why do I give valuable time to people who don't care if of me at the end of the day, Caligula would have blushed. Oh, you've been in the house too long, she said, and I naturally fled. In my life, why do I smile at people who I'd much rather kick in? Happy in the haze of a drunken hour.
You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My topic on tonight's show is Everything's Relative, and I'm playing you part of a TED Talk by Australian psychologist Brock Bastian, talking about how pain is relevant in our lives and should be welcome almost as much as pleasure, because there is a lot of value in experiencing pain.
Pain can increase our presence in life. You know, imagine making a sandwich, and as you're making that sandwich, you slip with a knife and you cut your finger. Now, what do? Do you continue to make the sandwich, or do you attend to your finger? Of course you attend to your finger. This is the function of pain. It interrupts everything else that we're thinking and feeling and doing, and it makes us focus on what's happening right here and right now. This is one of the reasons that people self-harm. The pain of self-harm distracts people who have a lot of negative thoughts. It brings them into the present, makes them less engaged with those negative thoughts and feelings. But you don't have to cut yourself to get that kind of effect. I mean, how many of us go for an extra long run when we're feeling bad, or perhaps for an extra hard workout at the gym? The pain in those experiences works in the same way. It stops us worrying about yesterday and tomorrow. It makes us more engaged with the present, with what's happening here, now. You know, mindfulness gurus have been teaching people to do this for a very long time. In some ways, pain is like a shortcut to mindfulness. Pain can also create meaning. It can give things a sense of purpose. Imagine running a marathon. Now, imagine running a pain-free marathon. It would be just as easy as sitting at home on your couch watching television. What would the point be? Imagine asking someone to sponsor you to run a pain-free marathon. Excuse me, will you give me $50 to run a pain-free marathon? No, I'm not going to give you $50 to run a pain-free marathon. I want to see you experience some pain to get that $50. I mean, who remembers the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge? People poured buckets of iced water over their heads and challenged other people to do the same. And in doing so, they raised an unprecedented amount of money for a good cause, a disease called ALS. Imagine if that was a bucket of confetti. Or what if it was eat a chocolate bar for the ALS challenge? It just wouldn't have worked. It was the pain of the iced water which made the cause worth our time and our money. Pain can also make us better people. I was living in Brisbane during the 2011 floods. People lost their homes and their livelihoods to the muddy waters of the Brisbane River. But this tragedy led to an outpouring of human generosity. 55,000 people turned up to help with the cleanup effort. At the end of the day, cleaning up was the easy part. It was knowing what to do with the 55,000 people that was the hard part. Pain is not all bad. It can add to our lives in important and meaningful ways. I mean, have you ever stopped to consider how comfortable our lives really are today? We live in climate-controlled houses. We have endless hot water for warm showers. We have electricity to power our lights and our devices. We wear fine fabrics. We walk in shock-absorbing shoes. We sit in comfort-adjustable seats. We choose which brand of water to drink and which cuisine to dine out on any night of the week. And should even a small amount of pain pierce its way through this pleasure-enhancing artillery, well, we have a painkiller for every occasion. So why is it then that in the midst of our capacity to maximise pleasure and minimise pain, are we experiencing an increase in pain problems, an increase in the number of pain clinics, in a reliance on pain-related medication, an increase in depression, an increase in anxiety, in the use of mood stabilisers and stress reducers? I think the answer lies in our relationship to pain. We've come to believe that our lives are supposed to be free of pain, and from this perspective, pain is a threat that needs to be avoided. But you've heard people say that you can be happy in spite of your pain. What I want to tell you today is far more revolutionary than that. What I want to tell you today is that we need pain to be happy. If you ask people what are the happiest moments of their lives, they'll tell you these three things: giving birth to their firstborn, graduating from an important course, and finding the love of their lives. But if we break these experiences down to find out what makes them truly powerful sources of happiness, we will find pain and failure and loss. Giving birth occurs in the context of great pain. Graduating is only so grand because you could have failed miserably. And finding the love of your life, well, that exposes you to the possibility of great loss. I think we need to build a new view of pain, one which starts to appreciate its value in our lives. Because the fact is, without pain, we could never experience any happiness at all.
You know, it's funny. I remember when I interviewed this, he's actually a psych professor himself at Carnegie Mellon, for my Value of Unhappiness show. He said, you could ask my father what were the highlights of his life. And he'd say, when I met your mother and fell in love, when I had you, the kids, and then my war experiences. He could talk for hours about his war experiences. They obviously weren't pleasurable per se, but the pleasure of having a cause and being with his peers and being brave and being in a group who are all completely engaged in the same cause was a huge source of happiness for him and the highlight of his life. So, everything's relative. That was the topic of my sharing hour tonight, brought to you on Laguna's KX935. I'm Sharon James. Do come back and listen to more Sharon Hours every Sunday night at 6. The Sharon Hour is a pun on my name, Sharon, Sharon James, but this is the kind of sharing with the left off G and the kind of hour with an H. You can Google it and listen to this show again anytime, either via iTunes or on our website, kx935.com, to which I suggest you attach yourself permanently. Ta-ta for now.